open the Senate Revenue Committee, and I think we'll begin. We're going to do a few bills. I don't think these should take too terribly long. One might need a little discussion, and we're going to come back to a work session on a bill Senator Hannon took the lead on. Elizabeth, if you're...
Senator Zuckert, actually, it's for the Department of Revenue. So we're just about ready, so go ahead.
Great. So we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 225. Mazin.
Chairman Decker, the Senate Bill 225, I've put in your packet a page that talks about the main points of the Senate Bill. Actually, this Senate Bill deals with about three or four different issues. It starts with the first one, what it establishes the real market value as the base for calculating the in lieu of property tax payments to school districts. That would be done by the ports. And in those, it will be 0.25% payments to school districts. The real market value seems to be the value that the different counties are using at this time, although I wasn't able to exactly check with all of them, and that might make a little more impact on some of the ports. And that what Section 1 of the bill does. Sections 2 and 3 establishes what is fondly known as the frozen growth maximum assessed value concept. And that concept works in the mostly all aspects of property tax evaluations. The couple exceptions that were missed at one point is the farm and forest home sites and open space lands. And these two sections, sections 2 and 3, establishes that process by freezing the growth of the time where there is a lot of volatility between real market value and assessed value to cap the growth of the maximum assessed value at not growth of 3%. Otherwise, if this wasn't here, the maximum assessed value will keep climbing by the 3% that is mandated in Measure 50. Section 4 of the bill puts those prior sections into action as in July 1st, 2004. Sections 5 and 6 deals with the estimates of assessed value and also injects the concept of the frozen growth of the maximum assessed value for the partially exempt and specially assessed properties. And I tried to put some of my understanding on how this works within the mathematical process of how that happens. Sections 7 and 8, they adjust and do some of how it gets into operation and in motion and puts effective date on it as July 1st, 2004 as well. Sections 9 and 10 takes out some requirements for the counties to use the automation for the assessment process. This basically is a housekeeping, makes it conform with a different statute, 308.234, and basically takes away that redundant language. In that sense, this bill actually has a potential of having a revenue impact, both from Section 1, where the real market value would be the one used for the school districts to get the in-lieu taxes or in-lieu payments of taxes. And Sections 2 and 3 as well as 5 and 6 could probably have some negative impacts based on if there will be a real volatility in the real market value, or if we truly see deflation in property value, where all the three different concepts of values, maximum assessed value, assessed value, and real market value start departing widely from each other. And that's, in a nutshell, I have an example that we might later look at if you choose. Department of Revenue would like to talk.
Thank you very much. Mr. Phillips? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Phillips with the Department of Revenue. Thank you. I think this is the one bill that gets the deepest into minutia for a property tax, and so I'll try to make it as clear as I can. The four issues here are clarification and deal with some of the changes that resulted as a result of Measure 50. The first issue in Section 1, as Mazen mentioned, was dealing with assessed value. And what we have are port properties are exempt from taxation by law, but properties that are leased to taxable entities in a port area are a special provision is given to them where they would pay an in lieu of tax. This in lieu of tax, according to the statute, then goes to schools, directly to schools. And so the calculation after Measure 50 was that the 0.25% of the value is what the number that the in lieu of tax is calculated based on. So using the assessed value for that calculation is problematic because for exempt properties like the Capitol building here, there is no assessed value. The assessor doesn't maintain an ongoing maximum assessed value in order to make the determination. So we have a real market value, but we don't have an assessed value necessarily. So counties, in calculating this, and this is primarily just counties with ports, of course, they have used different kinds of methods to calculate this in lieu of tax, such as some of the counties will use an assessed value that they fabricate and try to estimate as close as possible to be what it would be. In many cases, this type of property is actually the assessed value. If it were calculated, would be the real market value. So, in essence, for many of these properties, there's going to be no change in the tax, the in lieu of tax that they pay. I called five different counties and talked to the assessors there. Columbia, there was $100 of tax paid in lieu of in Columbia County, so it's not really a significant impact in Columbia. Clatsop has no accounts. Coos, the in lieu of tax paid on those accounts in Coos County totaled $755. And Wasco has two accounts. Multnomah has the most. And what we have in Multnomah is 17 accounts that are taxed at this fabricated, or if you will, assessor's best attempt to comply with the words assessed value in the statute, and 19 that make no difference because they're taxed based on their real market value. So that's just kind of an overview of the problems the assessors are facing with, and this was brought to us by the county assessors as an issue, and this is our attempt to find a solution. There are other alternatives to changing the assessed value term here to real market, and I can explore with you if you'd like and kind of talk about the effects of that. But this is what we felt would be the most revenue neutral. I can move on to sections 2 and 3. Sections 2 and 3 deal with maximum assessed value. In the Constitution, maximum assessed value, as you've heard, and you've heard testimony in the orientation, that it grows by 3% every year, except for certain kinds of exceptions. There was an issue discussed at the time Measure 50 was implemented, and people were concerned that when real market value was in a declining market where there was wide fluctuations, that the maximum assessed value would freeze instead of continuing to grow. You'll see an example of what might happen on the third page. And the line with the diamonds is the line where an example of what happens to maximum assessed value. It freezes such that when real market drops below and then it shoots up in the ninth year, that the shock is not from a taxable value of roughly $72,000 all the way to $152,000 that it actually only goes up to the line that the diamonds are on. So what this does in concept, and it does for all properties except these two because of an omission, it relieves the shock of the taxable value on certain taxpayers whenever market values fluctuate greatly. The reason why this hasn't come up before is because the home site values for farm and forest and open space real market values don't skyrocket and drop to the floor very often. So, Section 4, as Mazen pointed out, is an applicability date. Section 5 codifies the rest of that. The next page deals with Section 6, and this again refers back to the calculation of maximum assessed value. It's a complicated formula for normal types of accounts, but for accounts that are specially assessed and partially exempt, it's even more complicated. And we've given the county's guidance and our interpretation of the statutes with legal advice, and most of that calculation is inserted into various statutes as they've come up. And what we're doing here is we're saying that since we probably haven't covered all of them, we would like to put a general application calculation in Chapter 307 that says for any property that's specially assessed or partially exempt, here's how you calculate maximum assessed value. And to our knowledge, this is what's being done in the counties, and this is the way we've interpreted the Constitution to apply. So, an example of what can happen on a partial exemption, and there are different ways this is treated in the counties, is on that page. It shows a situation where you've got a partially exempt property, in this case I'll say a church, and because a church is a religious organization and if it qualifies, then it would receive property tax exemption. If part of that property is used for other than religious purposes, like say a daycare, then part of that property might not be exempt. So the assessor then determines the percentage to which the exemption applies. In this example, 50%. The assessors then have to make a decision. And they've made the decision in two of the options shown here. One, they say, oh, well, that's 50% reduction, so I'll reduce the real market value by 50%. And that gives me, instead of $100,000, it gives me $50,000. Other assessors might say, well, I'm to do that, but I'm also to reduce the maximum assessed value by 50%. So in example, option two, you'll see they reduce the $80,000 maximum assessed value by 50% also. And the ending result is an assessed value that is different between the two interpretations. So this change would also give guidance that it was option two is what the interpretation should be, and that the benefit then accrues to the property in that manner. The next page in subsection 2 of section 6 talks about specially assessed value and the various values that the county assessors maintain on each specially assessed account, and the end result of the formula that's mentioned in section 6 lays out some of these different situations where you have a specially assessed property. You could say it's a low-income housing property or a farm property that has a $100,000 value. The maximum assessed value is a portion of that, 80%, let's say, $80,000. Specially assessed value might be $75,000. And the point of this exercise is to say, well, for specially assessed property, what's their benefit of the Measure 50 rollback? And that is a maximum specially assessed value of $60,000. So this formula actually incorporates the rollback provision that Measure 50 gave all properties a rollback. Section 7 was a change made by legislative council since we were in the statute from granting to governing, referring to Chapter 307, special assessments and exemptions. Section 8 is an applicability section. And Section 9, 10, 11 deal with the final concept of this bill, and that is the existence of two different instructions in the statute for the Department of Revenue to guide or assist counties in how to appraise property on a mass appraisal basis. The the language that's in the statute in 308.234 says that we shall, and this was developed in the 80s when counties were just beginning to come up with computer-assisted appraisal, and it was to say, if you're going to develop this computer-assisted appraisal and data is going to be in a computer, maintained electronically, there should be some standardization as to how that's done across the state. And so this legislation was passed. We wrote a rule that described how that's done. And since then, and since the changes from Measure 50, two distinct changes have come in terms of mass appraisal. One, we eliminated the six-year cycle in which every 6 years the assessor would go out to a property and value it, and then they would go to a new appraisal area the next year, and every 6 years it would be back to the original place. And since Measure 50, and property is not necessarily taxed on real market value, there was a question about the need for doing that. So now in many counties, studies are done about the number of sales and the value of the sales and the value of property, and then trends are created and applied. And our direction has been to look also at results-based appraisal methods and leave the county some room to be creative in many of the counties, including Washington. So 308.027 no longer has the need for us to guide in that area, because 308.234 actually has language that will help us. It has rulemaking authority for us, and it also includes the results-based appraisal methods. I did include on the back a copy of our rule that references this, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that anyone has in this area. Thank you.
Good work. A lot of stuff in one deal. Senator Hannon.
John, why wasn't Section 2 and Section 3, the freezing of the maximum assessed value, dealt with in 97 when Measure 50 was enacted? Why are we now coming back with a piecemeal approach to deal with Major 50 property tax limitation?
Chair Deckert, Senator Hannon, I frankly do not believe that folks understood that this kind of calculation would need to be made. There were a number of, there was a lot of experience brought to bear on implementation of Measure 50, and the primary account we dealt with was a residential account. Just a straightforward residential account. And as we look at all of the variations of accounts and taxes and partial exemptions, and special assessments in the law, the assumptions were challenged and compared back to the Constitution and what it required, and there appeared to be a gap in the application of maximum assessed value for these kinds of properties. And so one by one, as we've approached statutes that talk about special assessments, like, for example, last session, low-income housing. There was a bill on low-income housing that created special assessments for those. And incorporated in that bill was this identical language that said that if, as they're specially assessed, it answered the question, how is maximum assessed value calculated? And that's exactly the same terminology. Last session also, there was a bill passed dealing with historic property out of this committee. And that historic property is a special exemption, special assessment, in that there's a freeze in the property value for 15 years. The question is how is the maximum assessed value calculated for those accounts? If there aren't real market value freezes for 15 years, what happens to the maximum assessed value? And so this language was placed in that statute also. So we made a determination, or we made an analysis, and drew conclusions after 1997, but putting into the statutes a comprehensive calculation for or method for maximum assessed value was not done until now. We were,
Mr. Chairman, is there typically a quicker rise in property valuation for these special assessments than there is residential property?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, the special assessments, the specially assessed property are so varied and so numerous that I really don't know if I can answer that. I think for farm or forest, you're less likely to see fluctuations. There have been instances where this has been necessary to make this comparison. The flow charts are mind-boggling. When we look at how the test we have to make, if you have a farm property that has a dozen or so farm soil classes, each class has its own real market value and its own maximum assessed value, and as it shows, it has a specially assessed value, and it also has a maximum specially assessed value, and it also has then an assessed value. So for each of those, for one property with multiple classes of soil, for example, there might be innumerable numbers of values that you might have to maintain.
What does this do to sales from farmland, 40 acres, 50 acres, and I have a farm assessment on this under the existing statute, and I choose to change it to a subdivision through the county plan, and so therefore I lose my special use exemption, and I have to retroactively go back 10 years. Under this calculation, if we were to change this now, and you look back 10 years, do you look back 10 years using the new formula, or do you look back 1 year using the new formula and 9 years using the old formula?
Senator Chair-Deckert, Senator Hannon, I believe and there is a county assessor in the audience too that could help me if necessary. But I believe that once a property is disqualified, then the taxes are calculated based on what the taxes would have been had it not been subject to special assessment.
No, you don't get me. You don't get my question.
I'm sorry.
The county assessor would come up. Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to ask a question here. If you have a program in place and you change the statute, the look-back provision for farm use assessment for changing that is 10 years. Is that correct?
Right. Depending on...
We need your name.
I'm Doug Ebner, Marion County Assessor. It depends on if you're inside Urban Growth Boundary or outside Urban Growth Boundary. If you're inside the city limits, there's a 5-year rollback. If you're outside, it's 10.
Okay. Let's just say we're inside the Urban Growth Boundary and there's only a 5-year look back. This law takes effect with the July 1st, 2004 tax year. And say in 2005 I decide to get my taxes forgiven because I'm going to subdivide my property. This is in 2005. The law has been in place for 1 year. Do you use the 1-year rollback or do you use the 4-year or 5-year rollback on the new law?
Senator Deckert, Senator Hannon, I think what we did before in the past is we compute each year individually. So if you disqualified in 2005, but this law took effect in 2004, we'd do one under the new formula. We'd do the other 4 under the old formula. I think that's the way it went in the past. We have to track that.
If I might interject, Chair Deckert, the section you're referring to is Section 6, Senator Hannon? Where we're talking about the
Section 6 and clarification of the term provision of law.
Okay. So what this section does, if I might, is, again, and maybe in a different way, is it says that if you're specially assessed, this is how one determines what the maximum assessed value of that property is. It doesn't, to my knowledge, and correct me if I'm wrong, Doug, is this doesn't talk about how you calculate a disqualification. Would you agree?
I would agree with that.
So for the period of time that a property is specially assessed, all of these values must be maintained in order to comply with the Constitution, and the lesser of is the amount that the person is taxed on. At the point the property no longer qualifies, then a calculation is done apart from these numbers to determine the amount of the disqualification penalty.
Okay.
And that is not being changed. Would you agree?
I agree.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 225?
I would like to, Mr. Chair, but I am absolutely lost.
Well, that's a reassuring thought.
I think we ought to penalize Senator Hannan for his questions. Look back 5 years.
You're deducted 2 points, Senator Hannan.
Okay.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 225 and open a work session on Senate Bill 225.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
We move 225 to the floor, unamended. The deal.
Yes. Senator Corcoran has moved Senate Bill 225 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Unamended.
Unamended.
Thank you very much.
Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to vote in support of sending it out, but I reserve the right to vote no on the floor because I want to check this out with my own county assessor.
Yeah.
I still feel a certain degree of uncertainty here. I heard the assessor saying one thing, and I heard the Department of Revenue saying something not quite exactly the same. But I want to check it out for further clarification, so I would just reserve that right.
Great, and we won't put this on the consent agenda. Any other?
Certain degree of uncertainty. Is that a Ashland term?
Yeah.
Okay.
Tara, go ahead and call the roll.
I'm uncertain.
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 225 passes. Senator Corcoran might be able to carry that. And we're going to need all our members to keep a quorum. And I will open a hearing on Senate Bill 228.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 228 is a bill that basically of a permission and authorization. It permits the disclosure of property valuations to leaseur or lessee, depending on these applications to different amounts of information. Also, the sections in the midsection of the bill authorizes the Department of Revenue to draft laws or rules by rule for disclosure of tax information to designated persons that are designated by taxpayers, basically. And in many ways, this is a disclosure and authorization bill, and it doesn't have revenue or a fiscal impact.
Mr. Phillips. And Ms. Buchanan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is John Phillips, the Department of Revenue. The section, I'll talk to Section 1, and then Deborah will cover the remaining sections of the bill. And Section 1 deals with confidentiality as is the whole bill, but for property and the property tax system, there's a certain amount of information that we get that's confidential, that's about businesses, that is not to be shared, and we carefully guard that information. There are situations that come up in which it might be useful to be able to share information, and this is just one such situation. What we encounter for leased property is We have returns that are filed by the information and reports that are filed by the lessee and the lessor for property. And when we look at both of them about what we think is the same piece of property, it's not clear to us that it is in fact the same piece of property. Sometimes the information we get is varied. It might be a large value versus a small value. It might describe the piece of property differently. And so in order to check with, let's say, the owner, get information from the lessee, and we check with the lessor about, you know, why is the information different, we can't really share with them why we think it might be different. We can't share with them the report that we got from the other party. And so what we're asking for is to be able to communicate between the owner of the property and the person that's actually using the property about the property. And the kinds of things we would need to communicate would strictly be related to the existence of the property, the location, the description, and the purpose is to determine the value. That's our job, is to determine the value of the property. We often get widely disparate reports on information between the two. Sometimes the owner reports something, but the lessee reports that they don't have it, and then we have to determine the value. We tell the lessor that there is no such piece of property according to the person that's supposed to be leasing it, and then they don't know. Often these leasing companies are out of state, and they don't have staff or time to commit to helping us sort it out. So the timeline we have is limited, and we end up probably inadvertently overtaxing people for property that maybe doesn't exist when we're not able to verify it. I provided an example on the second page that just talks about a business, let's say, that leases propane tanks, and they're an Idaho company. A service station in Oregon reports that the tank is a 2,000-gallon tank, but the owner's report says it's a 500-gallon tank. We don't know whether there was an upgrade, whether the service station is now leasing from another entity. We don't know about the value, and so in order to sort this out, we have to get written statements from both the lessor and the lessee, or whoever we're divulging information for. So our request is just about those kinds of circumstances. We think Section 1 specifically limits us to disclosing information that's relative to establishing the value of that property between those two entities.
So, John, what do you do now when you're given, similar to your propane example, how would you handle that without the statute change?
Currently, Senator Decker, currently what we're doing is we're calling the entity that reported the information and asking them if they're really, really sure what they reported was accurate, and maybe trying to get some more descriptions. So we're spending some phone time. Then what we're ending up doing is possibly asking for written authorizations to talk with the other entity or share the information that we've gotten with the owner, let's say. And if the written authorization doesn't come, then we put on the roll our best guess of what the property is. We don't have the staff to go out and visit all these sites to verify that actually it's a 2,000-gallon tank, let's say. So we would make some assumptions. There are times when we'll go out to various industries and do on-sites, like at a wood products facility. But like if it's a leased piece of property, like a Pitney Bowes machine, the value in sending someone physically out to a site or a propane tank would not be there, and we just don't have the staff. So we just give it our best estimate. And sorry, if I can tag on, what that does create is a lot of many corrections later on to the roll, where things are validated, or someone says this tax isn't right, I don't own this property, and then they show us that they don't, and then we end up correcting the roll. So,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Sections 2 through 5 are dealing with an unintended consequence from 1999 legislation, trying to correct that. We were advised in 1999 that we probably should clarify our ability to disclose information in proceedings before the Magistrate Division of the Tax Court, and we did that. It wasn't until 2002 that our attorneys advised us that perhaps we had inadvertently tied to a statute that limited our disclosure of tax return information to certain categories, and those are to attorneys and certified public accountants that are qualified to practice in Oregon or to licensed tax consultants. So as a result, we weren't able to talk about return information with any other party absent a power of attorney filed with us by the taxpayer.
which, as you might imagine, made our administration of the tax laws in some cases very difficult. So the provisions in sections 2-5 authorize us to disclose information to any person that the taxpayer designates as authorized to receive that information.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hannon.
Hate to be such a stubborn element here today. On page 2 of the bill, subsection B, information regarding the valuation of leased property reported on a property return, you're adding lines 22-26. Is this the restoration of the language that your attorney said you needed to add?
What page? You're on page 220.
Or page 3 of the bill. Page 3 of the bill, lines 22-26.
Chair Deckard, Senator Hannon, would you like me to answer that?
Okay.
That is the section that would give us the authorization to disclose between those parties. Information regarding the valuation, so it's limited to just the determination of the valuation of the leased property reported by the lessor to the lessee, and then the second sentence gives us the authority in the reverse order.
Have you run this by I'm not sure who'd run it by, but if I was a leasee, could I, in essence, find out additional information beyond just the value of the property?
Chair Deckard, Senator Hannon, I don't know how those conversations would go other than, you know, what is the piece of property, what's, you know, and then the unique characteristics of it. I don't.
Well, I draw your attention to sub E on line 12. It relates to the extent the return being disclosed relates to a case for which the Department of Human Services, the Division of Child Support, or the District Attorney is providing support enforcement services. All of a sudden you're broadening your definition from the leasee and the lessor to child support enforcement cases. And I'm not sure if I'm willing to open the door for you that far.
Chair Deckard, Senator Hannon, that's a very good point. Our concept has nothing to do with child support services or any of the others mentioned.
No, but it's here.
It's
new language.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And these were changes made by legislative counsel in the ordering of changing the deleted words to the bolded words for reasons that legislative counsel determined.
Ms. Buchanan.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I believe the bolded language in those particular lines is clarifying what exists already in that particular subsection. The Department of Human Services and Division of Child Support of the Department of Justice and District Attorney are there, but it's clarifying the extent to which those can be disclosed, I believe, is what the bolded language is doing with that.
I'm sure legislative counsel is on its way, but that is my understanding, and my meeting with Mazin this morning was that it is not a substantive change, but rather one that just clarifies the existing statute. But
so you're blaming it on Mazin?
I am. I'm saying that Mazin is the person responsible for
it. I think that's really unfair, Mr. Chair.
So noted.
Aren't you going to dock him 2 points, too?
2 points to Senator Farquhar.
Thanks.
Dexter?
Mr. Chair, members, good afternoon. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office. The question has to do with subparagraph E here.
Right. This is what we're trying to change. D is the only remaining relative.
Line 10, page 3. Changing
the wording.
Yeah. Now, the substance isn't being changed here. It is simply clarifying, for example, in line 13, the phrase regarding cases for which they are, which is being deleted, clarifying that they can only disclose that for to the expense return is related to a case that they're involved in.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hannon.
Dexter, the reason I asked the question was in line 22 of the same page, subsection B, I asked the question, information regarding the valuation of leased property, what other information would be obtained or available by a lessee or a lessor requesting the information? In other words, could I find out additional information about the lessee beyond just a contractual relationship that I have?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I believe the only information you would be entitled to receive would be information on the value of the property. Yeah. You would not be able to find out any other information about a lessee or a lessor.
So there are exceptions for the information they share with these entities, only to the extent they collect.
That's fine. And that's existing law. The only new change is this subparagraph B, my recollection.
So if I might point to section 7 at the bottom of page 2, line 44, where it says all returns shall be held confidential. This is the part of the bill, it's part of the statute that says these returns are confidential. And so following that are the subsections that say here are the conditions under which a release or disclosure can be made. And then it provides the notwithstanding clause, and then it refers to releasing information to the Department of Revenue, Secretary of State, County Tax Collector, and then in large D on line 10, page 3, any reviewing authority to the extent the return is being disclosed relates to an appeal brought by the taxpayer. So that would be releasing the information to the taxpayer for purposes of an appeal. And then certain allowances have been made in the past for the Department of Human Resources Child Support Division to release information to them. And the way the law was crafted before, it was regarding cases which they are. So it was saying we can release this information listed in sub 7 to the Department of Human Resources Child Support Division, but only to the extent they have cases. And the wording is being changed to say the same thing, I think, in just a more artful way.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, if I may, that actually at subparagraph D change on line 10 is a very good example. The existing law says as to those returns relating to appeals by taxpayers, it's much broader actually than, because you're just appeals to taxpayers as a general statement, and it's a little bit more precisely stated when it says to the extent the return being disclosed relates to an appeal brought by a specific taxpayer.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other? Thank you very much. Good work. Thanks. Anyone else on Senate Bill 228? Close the public hearing. Open a work session on Senate Bill 228.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 228 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 228 to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. That bill was, people were so interested in that, I think I will carry that bill, given the incredible interest there was on the committee. That bill. Thank you, John. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 229. Mr. Malik, what does this bill do?
Mr. Chair, this this bill attempts to deal with remnants of law or a case that was treated by fixing the law back in the 1999 session. The bill itself changes the due date for additional taxes that become owed as a result of a court decision. It moves those additional taxes to be paid free of fees and interest if they are paid by the 18th of the month following the court decision. 18th or the 16th? 16th, sorry. And the other thing that it does, if that payment is not made before the 16th of the next month, then those taxes would become considered delinquent since the day they were imposed. And that's in a nutshell what it does. This has or have a potential of having a revenue impact of basically a positive revenue impact for the taxing districts because it brings back the payment time from what now exists as the time for the next property tax bill, if you will, for the next year, brings it back to the time just right after the resolution of the dispute. So it has that potential of speeding up the payments of the delinquency and saving the time value of money, and in the same time, that a second impact comes from adding delinquency and interest charges for the additional taxes that the court judges for.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Decker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 229. When errors are discovered on the property tax roll, and we've talked a little bit about these before, from, let's say, omitted property or some other such clerical error, and the assessor discovers it and adds the value to the property tax account, and we talked about before how the value can go back 5 years and the taxes accumulated then are due, that amount that's due can actually be substantial, and for a residential taxpayer, let's say, it can be a very, very ominous responsibility to meet all of that, and that's exactly what happened and generated a bill in 1999, Senate Bill 125. Multnomah County, a residential taxpayer, received this bill, could not pay it. That put the count into the foreclosure mode, and the person was, you know, threatened to lose their home. So the bill in 99 said that, and the testimony, and I did look up the staff measure summaries at that point, listen to the hearings. It did talk about whenever value is added as a result of omitted property or a clerical error, that the person should have at least, not the 16th of the month following the correction, but they should have on the following general tax roll, along with their next year's tax statement, they get a chance to pay for that. And so it did give them a little more time. And depending on when the roll was corrected, it would give them anywhere between 5 and 15 months additional to make that payment. So that provided relief for those situations. But because of another type of situation where the roll is corrected, where let's say you disagree with your property value, you appeal it, the appeal takes a year, and you've alleged a certain value and the assessor had a certain value on the roll, but the court actually finds that the final value is higher than what the assessor had on the roll. So your taxes owing are actually more than what your tax statement showed. And that's the part of the taxes that we're talking about in this bill. We're saying once the court case is finished and the appeal is final, the judge rules, the value then is placed on the roll by the county assessor, and under current law, as a result of that 99 change, that appellant then gets up between additional 5 and 15 months to pay that tax because of a reference in the law that linked it with the other types of corrections that were being made and addressed in the 99 session. So our question to you is just, there wasn't a policy discussion about that at the time, and so this bill just puts that policy decision before you now, and the choices are the current law, which says that the person, once they've appealed, and only in those cases where there's more taxes owed, more value owed than what even the assessor had on the tax roll, should they be responsible for paying that? Should the due date be the month following the date that the roll is corrected, which is the way it was prior to 99? Or should it be under the way that the law links it today to that following next year's general tax roll? And that's what this does. It provides in Section 2, it's just a general statement relating to appeals, that whenever property value or a claim of exemption cancellation is appealed to the Board of Property Tax Appeals for final resolution, and additional taxes are due.
John, are there any cases that this would affect out there, that this enactment of the statute would affect pending appeals or pending litigation that you know of?
Let me just read this again. Chair Deckert, I am not personally aware of any, but that isn't to say that there aren't any. Mm-hmm. And I think it could be, I mean, that brings up a really good point, that it maybe better language might be for appeals initiated after the effective date of the bill. It wasn't our intention to try to pick up an appeal that's already in the process.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good point.
Ninety-one days.
Questions for the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Hasn't.
If I may add, on the other hand, if the tax, the taxpayer is shown to not owe that amount of money, or actually a decrease is ordered by the court or the board, that refund should occur to the taxpayer with an interest amount that the taxpayer will be paid.
Yeah.
Isn't that correct, John?
Chair Deckard, members of the committee, that's true. In the reverse order, where the value is lowered, then the county then has to make a refund. They don't wait until the next tax roll. They make the refund after the roll is corrected, and to the extent they're not able to make that payment right away, the interest accrues at 12%. So
yeah. We're gonna have a bill that's coming to have a hearing on that 12% issue.
Okay.
So we will have a similar relating clause. Perhaps we'd want to change this and make that one small change to ensure that there's no existing cases out there that we would negatively, or I guess it would be only negatively for the taxpayer effect. Great. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 229, and perhaps we'll just have that drafted. Great. Thanks. Open a work session on Senate Bill 232. Senator Hannan.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members. Senate Bill 232 was the bill that was read and testified before our committee, I believe, a week and a half ago. What it addressed was an issue in, I believe, Clackamas County, where a person was on property tax deferral and the taxes were paid to local government, and the person subsequently donated the property for the purposes of a park. If you'll recall, I raised the issue at the time about having an option in there for local government to consider. Mr. Rydell from the County's Association representing the county assessors met with the Department of Revenue, Mr. Phillips, and they concurred that perhaps this statutory language was appropriate, and that we should consider passing it as is without amendments.
Sure.
So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would move that we send Senate Bill 232 out to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Hannan has moved, and I would note the letter that we have from the counties, which thanks Senator Hannan for raising the issue and bringing this a consensus about on this issue. Senator Hannan has moved Senate Bill 232 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Hannan, if you can carry that on the consent agenda.
No. No, okay.
Got my attention on that. Committee, next up we have David Longenecker, who we're very fortunate to have. He is the executive director of WICHE. He has a 15-minute presentation for us. He's in from Denver and has rearranged his flight. Mr. Longenecker, I'm going to get your bio a little bit wrong, but I know he was the assistant to the Secretary of Education for Higher Ed Policy and now serves as our Executive Director of the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education, which is many of the western states in the United States. And we have him here for about three or four more hours before he departs. If he can get the technology done. So we're just very pleased. You have the presentation in front of you. I have heard it, or a version of it, once, and it was one of the better analysis of higher education and financing issues in the Western region. Yeah. Mr. Longenecker.
Thank you, Chairman Decker, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you. As mentioned, I'm David Longenecker. I'm the Executive Director of the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education. The presentation I have is actually one that I prepared for a legislative breakfast this morning, and a portion of that has to do with WICHE per se, and we're celebrating WICHE's 50th anniversary, and we're sort of going around and talking about how important WICHE has been to each of you as member states. I'll cover that very briefly and then talk a bit about the environment that's facing higher education in the West, and particularly in Oregon, at the present time. I don't know if you are aware of it, but WICHE actually began here in Oregon. First executive director had been a vice president for academic affairs at the University of Oregon and set up our offices in Eugene in 1953, a year after we'd been incorporated as a congressionally chartered compact. Then of 11 states and two territories, Alaska and Hawaii. And since they've become full member states, obviously, and then North and South Dakota have joined. So we're now an organization with 15 members. Our second executive director's wife was from New Mexico, and she wasn't a duck. And our offices are now in Boulder, Colorado, where we moved down as we came. We're a simple, mission-driven organization that exists to provide access to high-quality education for the citizens of the West. We do so that through interstate collaboration, and we do so not for higher education, for the sake of higher education. Higher education is a means to an end. We do it basically because higher education is so important to the economic, social, and civic vitality of the West. You're ably represented by Senator Decker, Commissioner Cruz Braley of the Community Colleges, and Vice Chancellor Diane Bynes from the Oregon University System. You're also represented on our Legislative Advisory Committee by Ryan and by Representative Becker. We pursue our goals by basically trying to expand access, provide policy work, promote effective, essentially promote innovation through use of things like educational technologies and fostering interstate collaboration. We're probably best known for our student exchange programs. Oregon's been a very active part of our student exchange programs, all of them. We have three. The best known and the granddaddy of those is the Professional Student Exchange Program. This is where you buy seats for Oregonians to attend programs in other states, and where other states buy seats for their students to attend institutions in your state. Currently, you are sending 18 students. I'm sorry. Currently, you're sending 18 students to other states in three fields, but you're receiving 144 students from other states in your fields, and they're bringing with them $1.8 million in payments from those states to Oregon. This is the second largest payment to a state in the Wichita, and of the 15 Wichita states. Only you follow only Colorado in terms of the number of slots that other states buy in your system. So Wichita is important to Oregon, and Oregon is extremely important to Wichita. At the present time, you've got over 400 professionals who are alumni of the Wichita programs practicing in the state, and about two-thirds of those students that you support come on back to the state. Our most popular program at the present time is our Western Undergraduate Exchange. About 1,200 students from Oregon this past fall participated in institutions in other states. And what they get through this program is an advantage rate on tuition. They pay 150% of the resident tuition. The benefit of this advantage was $5.7 million for Oregonians attending other institutions in the West this past year. This is a truly reciprocal program for you folks in that you're getting just about the same number of students as you're sending. You're receiving about 1,300 students into your institutions of higher education and sending 1,200. We have a third program. It's a much smaller program, as you can see from this, the Western Regional Graduate Exchange Program. And obviously, the students who participate in these, as these testimonials indicate, are very pleased with the program. But Wichita is a lot more than the student exchange programs. We offer, I mentioned earlier, the Western Cooperative for Educational Telecommunications, which is a program that helps states, institutions in those states, now even other nations, look at how to provide high-quality distance learning through the use of technology, how to manage that, how to afford it, and how to assure that it's high quality. We also do a lot of policy analysis and research. We're working, for example, at the present time with the Oregon University System and the community colleges on a project called Changing Directions, where we're helping to provide some funding through a Lumina Foundation grant to help them do some strategic planning about how to deal with the unique challenges that you're facing. We offer a lot of programs and services in addition to the student exchange programs. We have a mental health program that has served the West for about 50 years, and you folks are represented in that by, Ann Brand is the person who represents you from the Department of Health and Human Services. We also have an offshoot called the Consortium for North American Higher Education, which helps provide faculty-student exchanges and works with policymakers in Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, in helping to facilitate the exchange of ideas between those three communities. But that's sort of where things have been in the past. What I'd like to really focus on here is the unique circumstances facing Oregon in higher education, and really what you face is what I call the perfect storm. It's the result of three waves that are cresting. The first of those is an increasing demand for higher education in your state. Second is a substantial change in the nature of the students that you are serving. You're serving a much more difficult clientele than you used to. And the third is that constrained finances that you face, as you well know, as you face every day in your current jobs. If you look at the first of those, the first wave in this perfect storm, the increasing demand, it's really a function of two different factors. The first is simple demographics. Well, you're going to see an increase of about 24%, we estimate, over the next decade. And this is on top of a pretty substantial increase in the last couple of years. And it's the reason for this is two. One is simple demographics, and the other is you have some policy objectives that, if achieved, would increase your participation in higher education. First, looking simply at demographics, you've got more people. More people mean more high school graduates. You've certainly seen this over the last decade. You'll continue to see that. That's not to say anything about the adult students that now are believing our rhetoric and going back for lifelong learning because of the need to do so for their vocational reasons and for avocational reasons. And so you've got this collision of adult students and increasing numbers of young people coming out of high school who will want to go on to some form of post-secondary education.
But there's a second reason, which is your policy goal, which is to increase the participation in post-secondary education. Your high school grad rates are basically holding about steady. They're higher than the national average. That's good news. The problem is they're going down slightly. You're one of the few states in the country where you're actually experiencing a decline in your high school graduation rates. At least let me say that more accurately. The share of your 18 to 22 year to 24 year olds in the census that have a high school degree. Now that could be because of declining high school graduation rates, or it could be because of immigration of students who don't go to high school, but the share of your population, young population, that have a high school degree is going down. And that's contrary to most of the rest of the country, and is not a good sign for you as a state. You also have a smaller percentage of students who are going on to college than the rest of the West or the rest of the country as well. And again, you're going in the wrong direction. Your college participation rate has declined substantially since 1996. And had I gone back further, you would see that the decline has actually been going down more dramatically than is even reflected here. So you have a goal of increasing your policy participation, or your participation rate. But you also have a goal of greater success in completing college. You're about average in associate degree production and a little bit below average in your baccalaureate degree production. The real tragedy in American higher education is that so many of our students start higher education, but relatively few of them complete their degrees. This is really an anomaly in the world. The rest of the world, interestingly, has accepted our philosophy of engaging a far larger share of their population in higher education, but they haven't adopted our strategy of then carrying them to completion. And so we now find that we no longer lead the world in the share of our population with a college education. We now rank below six other countries, and we are in a group with about 10 countries that will all pass us at the under current trends over the next decade, at which point the United States would not any longer be a leader in the share of its population with a post-secondary education at the degree level. Now, there's one consolation, I suppose, and that's that you're not alone in this demographic dilemma. California, Nevada, and Texas have a much more significant challenge than you do, percentage-wise and number-wise, and most of the rest of the West is right there with you. So demographics and increases in demand will be something that faces the entire West. The second wave is that those students you serve will be harder to serve, and harder to serve students generally require more resources. An increasing share of your population is going to come from communities of color. You'll see an increase in the share of your high school graduates that come from minority communities, increasing, doubling over the next decade from about 15% to 30%. And that'll be driven almost entirely by the Hispanic, increases in the Hispanic population, which will triple during that period of time.
Mr. Chair.
So what's wrong with that? There's really nothing wrong with greater diversity. We all celebrate diversity and, in fact, look forward to that. But,
one quick question.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
But what assumptions are you basing that statement on?
This is
those
based
we
on
serve
the,
will be harder to serve?
Well, I'll come exactly to that. That's the reason that they're harder to serve is that traditionally we have, in higher education, done a particularly poor job of serving communities of color. And the research on that suggests that it's both because of the culture of our communities and because of the economic the educational disadvantages many of those students bring into the environment. Just to use statistics for Oregon, today 8% of your population is Hispanic, 7% of your high school graduates are Hispanic, 4% of your college enrollments, initial enrollments are Hispanic, 3% of your graduates are. And that's very typical of the rest of the country. We tend to have about half the productivity, the end line production on this educational production function for students of color as we do for our majority students. That doesn't mean the future has to be there, but it does mean that we have to find ways in which we can better serve students of color than we traditionally have. And it's very related to this issue, which is we have the same
exact correlation with students from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. Traditionally, they're about half as likely to participate in post-secondary education, and that number has been going down, as reflected here, and Oregon is substantially below the national averages in serving those economically disadvantaged students.
For lack of not wanting to get into a debate here, I just put a statement of caution here that we don't treat people of different ethnic differences different. I think there's reason to be cautious.
Yes, I'm just trying to point out that we have challenges ahead of us, not that we should.
Challenges ahead of us across all races of the human race,
absolutely.
Every Oregonian, and to differentiate folks within different groups, I would just urge caution.
Point well taken. There is some good news for Oregon. You have broader participation in recent years in rigorous high school curriculum, students taking advanced placement, students taking core curriculum, and in students taking the SAT and the ACT exams, and they're scoring better, so that there certainly are some good points for the state. Now, the third wave perfect storm is limited resources. Yeah, you know this one very well, and what a difference a couple of years make. In 1999, 2000, life couldn't have been much better. In Oregon, your budgets were increasing between that biennium 1997-99 and 2001-2003. That one biennium there, you had about a 10% increase in your state budget. You had 21% increase in higher education, and the good news is your folks could afford it because their incomes were going up by that amount in the state. But that didn't last for very long. 2 years later, we're looking at budget deficits for you for this current year of over $1 billion for this budget, and an estimated $2 billion for the next biennium, if I understand correctly, and probably no foreseeable turnaround in that in the short term. Your support for higher education has been has declined by 10.6% over
David,
this biennium.
We learned on that statistic that we were first in the country. We got ranked as leading in per capita cuts to higher ed. In the West, have other states gone, obviously not as deep, but have they been going at higher ed also?
Actually, the national NCSL just came out with a report that showed that higher education was the most frequent and most significant area of cuts, and one of the logical reasons for that is that there's an alternative source of revenue which most public services don't have, that being tuition. And so there's generally, even though people aren't crazy about what they're doing, it's one of the ways of providing relief that often isn't. There's the safety valve, if you will. Idaho has gone very deep into higher education. California has not, but will be. Their budget deficit will force that. Colorado went at 12% this past year. I think actually Colorado may surpass you after they finish up their cuts. They haven't finished them. They've announced some, and those aren't factored in yet into the final numbers for this coming year. So it's not an unusual circumstance in the West or elsewhere in the country. And as a result of these cuts, higher education now is a much smaller share of your budget than it used to be. You're investing substantially less in higher education than was traditionally the case. And frankly, the prospects look grim. Things don't look like they're going to be turning around. The information from the National Association of State Business Officers suggests that it takes 18 to 24 months for state government budgets to turn around after the economy has turned around. And while there are some people around the country who are saying the economy is turning around, it doesn't look that way in most of the western states with which I work. So it's going to be a while before we see any rebound. Recent study by the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education, National Center for Higher Education Management Systems, done by the State University of New York at Albany's Center for State Government, shows that almost all of the states are going to face structural budget deficits by the year 2008. Oregon is one of those states. You are projected to face about a 1.5% per year structural budget deficit. And this is driven by the nature of the services you provide, the demand for those services, and particularly things like Medicaid, which are mandated expenses that you will have to incur, but that are eating up a larger share of the state resources than traditionally has been the case. And to some extent, and germane to this committee, a function of the antiquated revenue systems that we have in this country, revenue systems that were really designed for an economy of the 20th century, in some cases maybe the 19th century, but we're operating them in a 21st century environment. The dilemma for your system of higher education is that as a result, your financing policies just won't measure up. Your institutions will lack the financial capacity to increase their operating capacity to meet that increasing demand that I mentioned earlier. Your system is running very efficiently today. Now, they would say they're underfunded by 26% because they're operating at 74% of the average of their peer institutions nationwide in the university system, about 88% of the average cost per student in the community college system. And I'm sure they would tell you that that means they're underfunded. Another way to look at that is that they're really quite efficient, quite productive compared to the norm in this country. You've got a very strong university system. It does a good job, provides quality education. All of your presidents would come in and tell you that, and they would be right. And so you're getting a great deal out of it. But what it really suggests is that there's not as much flex in your system as there might be elsewhere. And as a result, it's going to be very difficult for them to sustain high-quality education and to provide increased access to that 24% increase in enrollments that I was projecting earlier. When you rank 33rd nationally, it doesn't give you a whole lot of leverage within a system. So access is at risk in your system. And that's a result of a variety of things. One is that you have one of the highest tuition rates in the West. Now, there's nothing essentially wrong with a high tuition structure. In fact, you can make a pretty strong public policy case that that's a rational way of providing for this service. There are tremendous personal advantages to achieving a higher education, and so the return on investment is very substantial, and it's a highly valued good, so that there's nothing inherently wrong with the tuition structure that you have. Your problem is that you have no safety net for those students who come from families that simply can't afford this. You've got an inadequate student financial aid system. Your system is ranks well behind the national averages and far behind the best in the West. The two states that in the West that have the best financial aid systems border you, California and Washington. And you, particularly given your tuition structure, just don't have a system that will really foster access for students who come from low economic backgrounds. And I think one of the real dilemmas that you've got is there's no intentional integration between the two. In fact, you got some black marks in the higher education community nationwide this year by reducing your funding for need-based financial aid when you reduced your appropriations. And all of that makes for the perfect storm: increasing demand, likely through unlikely increase, increasingly difficult to serve students, and limited finances. And that's really the dilemma that you face. Part of your dilemma is that you can respond to this. You can weather this this plan partly through changing directions. And in fact, you've got a grand planning effort going on in the Oregon University system and elsewhere. But the solutions for this really part of them will come out of higher education and out of your education committees. But in fact, just higher education is just one of many public services that are extremely valuable to Oregon that you're going to have a hard time supporting if you don't change your revenue structure somewhat to respond, because there just isn't going to be a level of revenue sufficient to support the public services in the state. We think, obviously, at WICHE that interstate collaboration makes sense. Working with other states, we think, can be a resource. But ultimately, most of the solution is going to have to come internally. And the question really isn't whether to weather the storm or not. It is how to weather the storm. Chancellor Jarvis has done, I think, a really nice job of sort of laying out what the issues are that you face: growing demand, limited resources, and an inadequate financial aid system to fit your current financing structure. You have a bit of a challenge ahead of you, but I think that's what's, I suppose, fun about working in public policy. Thanks for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you, David. Appreciate your time, and I think I'll see you in about
in a few minutes.
20 or 25
yeah.
minutes. I'll let you get set up for
Great.
The Senate Education Committee, but
Great.
Thank you for the presentation.
You bet. My pleasure. Thank you very much for the chance.
With that, we will adjourn Senate Revenue for the afternoon.